Afternoon. Call our case for today, 06AP672CR, State v. Lewis H. LeCount. Representing Mr. LeCount is Attorney Christopher Kelly. Mr. Kelly?
May it please the court, my name is Chris Kelly and I represent Lewis LeCount in this appeal from judgments of conviction in Brown County. Mr. LeCount's appeal, or his convictions, were affirmed by the Court of Appeals, and he has raised four issues on review before this court. The first two pertain to his conviction for securities fraud. One is whether a lawyer's expert testimony regarding the nature of an investment contract is inadmissible. And the second is whether the evidence was sufficient to support his conviction for securities fraud. The third issue in the case is whether the evidence supports convictions on three of the counts that depended upon evidence that was gathered in a search, and whether the evidence was derived from an illegal search. And the last issue that we're raising is whether the sentence of Mr. LeCount as a repeater or an habitual criminal violated his Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial. Turning then to the issue of the expert witness, the majority rule, which has been adopted in Wisconsin, is that the only expert in American law is the judge who presides over the trial. Expert testimony by a lawyer about American law is not permitted. That rule has been articulated twice in Court of Appeals opinions, and it is the majority rule for good reason. An expert in the law interferes with what in the American system is the exclusive authority, which has been delegated to judges to determine what the law is. Judges define the law in the case, and judges communicate those definitions of the law to the jury via jury instructions. We do not allow experts to interfere with judicial authority to decide what the law is by getting on the witness stand and opining what the expert believes the law is.
Mr. Kelly, isn't the standard of review in regard to the expert testimony question highly deferential? Don't we accord deference to the discretionary decision made by the court?
It would be in a typical case where the expert is a doctor, an engineer, something like that, and the question that the trial judge has to decide is essentially just, is this going to be helpful to the jury? There is no deference owed in this case because the question here is, did the judge apply the correct legal test? And when we're asking, did the judge apply the correct legal test, we don't defer to a judicial determination that is premised on an incorrect view of the law. And that's what happened here. In this case, the trial judge applied what would be the typical rule for expert testimony, which is this going to be helpful to the jury? But he didn't ask, is that rule different when the expert who is testifying is a lawyer who is going to be testifying about domestic law? And although that issue was presented to the court in a motion in limine, the judge either didn't recognize or disregarded that there is an exception to the general rule about how to make that discretionary determination when we're talking about an expert in the law. The judge
didn't this have to do with the characteristics of an investment contract and what that meant?
Part of the expert's testimony had to do with the characteristics of an investment contract. But I think characteristic or feature or any of those words that have been used to describe what this expert testified about are really just another way of saying he explained the law to the jury. He explained the legal definition of investment contract to the jury. Now, whether you characterize that as talking about the features or the characteristics of an investment contract, he's still defining legally what an investment contract is. And that's expert testimony about American law. It should have been the function, and it was the function, of the trial judge to tell the jury, here's what an investment contract is. Here's what its characteristics are. Here are the features of an investment contract. You decide whether this transaction involved an investment contract.
Well, the judge did give such an instruction, did he not?
He did give an instruction, and the instruction contradicted the testimony given by the expert, or rather the expert contradicted the jury instruction as to what the characteristics of an investment contract are. That's one of the reasons that it was so prejudicial to have this expert testifying about what an investment contract is.
In what regard did the expert's testimony contradict the definition set out in the jury instruction that was given?
The jury instructions essentially advised the jury that an investment contract depends
I have the jury instruction that was given in front of me where it says elements of the crime that the state must prove.
And the portion that was contradicted was the sentence in the jury instruction that reads, if an investor uses his own efforts to achieve a profit rather than relying on the efforts of a promoter or third party, the investment does not constitute a security. That portion of the definition of investment contract is consistent with a couple of United States Supreme Court cases that are cited in our brief. But the expert testified that it doesn't matter whether the investors use their own efforts, as long as there are significant managerial efforts of a third party. The nature of the arrangement as an investment contract isn't destroyed simply because an investor uses some of his own efforts or her own efforts in order to obtain the profit or to obtain the end of the investment.
Counsel?
Yes.
This was testimony that was subject to cross or could have been subject to cross-examination, right?
It was subject to cross-examination, yes.
Let me give you a hypothetical and tell me what the problem, if any, is this. Let's say you have a legal malpractice case. Let's say it involves whether or not an estate planning case. And so it involves IRS regulations, and you have a couple of lawyers testifying, and the defendant lawyer didn't do something right in an estate planning document to and the consequences were several $100,000, of course, because the estate planning document allegedly wasn't up to snuff. So you have, for the plaintiffs, you have a person doing, specializing in work in estate planning, saying, well, you know, under the IRS code, this is what you have to do, and then it's informed by a couple of private letter rulings or something, and so as a result, the plaintiff says, he didn't do that, no problem. And then you have a defense witness who's an attorney who's from the law firm down the street and who says, oh, but you really can't rely on those private letter, what are they called, Chief? You used to do this all the time. Anyway, private letter rulings, and what he did was okay. So aren't you having two lawyers who specialize in estate planning testifying to their understanding of what the law is and whether or not the defendant attorney followed the law? What's wrong with that?
To the extent that the experts are testifying about what the law is, what's wrong with it is that it violates Wisconsin precedent and the majority rule that only the judge should be telling the jury what the law is.
How is the plaintiff going to prove the case?
Well,
because the law represents, the standard of care, really. Yeah.
Sure, but that can be explained to the jury in the jury instructions. I don't think there's a problem with a lawyer testifying, here is what a reasonably prudent lawyer would do. If you're talking about what actions a lawyer would take.
He would follow the law, and the law is. That's my point.
But I don't think that the expert can testify, and the law is. I think if the jury is going to be told, the law is X, that has to come from the judge, because only the judge can decide whether the law is X or Y.
Yeah,
I don't think we can have a battle between plaintiff's lawyer and defendant's lawyer about what the law is, because that's the job of the judge to tell the jury what the law is.
There's a difference between instructing the jury and testifying. The standard, it seems to me, is will it assist the trier of fact? If I were a trial court judge, it might assist me to have, it may assist me to have that kind of testimony in a malpractice case dealing with those issues.
Well, I don't think the judge is looking to experts who testify in the case to assist the judge in deciding what the jury instruction should be or what the law is. And I think it's prejudicial to do that, because if the judge ultimately disagrees with what the expert testifies, or agrees with one but doesn't agree with the other, the poor jury is left there with conflicting opinions, and who knows whose opinion they're going to listen to or whether they're going to listen to the jury instructions. And that's what's prejudicial about this case. We have the lawyer from the Department of Financial Institutions testifying about one definition of what an investment contract is. We have jury instructions giving a different definition, and the two are in conflict.
But
we don't know what the jury followed.
I thought the Court of Appeals said that the description of the expert matched that of the jury instruction.
But it didn't in the important respect that
so
I just
explained.
So you
disagree with the Court of Appeals?
Yes,
then.
Yes.
Okay.
And I think the record makes it absolutely clear that the expert from DFI greatly expanded the definition of what is an investment contract that was presented to the jury in the jury instructions. The expert testified, well, basically everything is an investment contract. If we don't know what else to call it, we call it an investment contract. That's not particularly helpful testimony under any standard. And when the expert was cross-examined about, how much effort can an investor put in of his own in order to realize a profit before an investment or a shared investment turns into an investment contract, or I guess the other way around. How much effort can this person put in before an investment contract just becomes an shared investment? He couldn't answer the question. He said there's a line there. It's a fuzzy line. I don't really know where that line is. Again, that's not testimony that's helpful to the jury, and that's one of the reasons that the testimony given by this expert was prejudicial. It wasn't harmless error, because it simply confused the jury. But more importantly, it contradicted the jury instructions. And although the Court of Appeals said that we presume juries follow jury instructions, that presumption makes very little sense in a case like this one, where the expert is testifying for the express purpose of assisting the jury in understanding the law. We can't believe that the jury is just going to disregard all of the testimony they've heard, including the expert's opinion that, in response to a hypothetical question, that what he's been told the evidence is, in his mind, is consistent with an investment contract. The jury's not going to just ignore all of this supposedly helpful testimony once they hear a jury instruction that contradicts what the expert testified to.
Well, doesn't the four-way case basically talk in terms of Wisconsin having a broad rule in regard to how much the investor can be involved in the actions necessary to turn a profit? So isn't the expert here actually sort of right on when he says this is not a clear-cut line that can be drawn? I understand there are federal cases that say it's got to be solely the actions of the person with whom the investment is made. But that doesn't seem to be Wisconsin law.
I think whether Wisconsin law exactly tracks federal securities law is somewhat ambiguous. And Justice Crooks, you might be right. Perhaps Wisconsin law differs from federal law. And perhaps the DFI lawyer was more or less correctly expressing what Wisconsin law is. But that doesn't save the conviction, because Mr. LeCount wasn't tried on the theory of what the DFI lawyer thought the law is. He was tried on the theory that was presented to the jury in the jury instructions. And he can't be convicted on a theory that's different from the legal theory that is presented to the jury in the jury instructions. That's the Alderman case from the United States Supreme Court. So, again, I don't think this court in this case has to decide whether Wisconsin securities law perfectly tracks federal securities law, because the law that matters here is the law that was given to the jury in the jury instructions, and the jury instructions were stipulated to by both sides in this case. And that segues into the second issue, which is that if the jury had followed the jury instructions, it would have been required to acquit Mr. LeCount, because the complaining witness, Mr. Wills, basically testified that he was one of, or as he understood it, he was one of five people who were putting money into an investment in order to acquire some real estate that would then be resold at a profit. Mr. Wills testified a couple of times that that was his understanding of what this deal was. That kind of an arrangement under the law as explained to the jury in the jury instructions is not an investment contract, because that understanding didn't involve any third party at all who would be doing anything. The five investors were simply pooling their money, buying property, reselling it, and splitting the profit. That's a shared investment. That's not an investment contract. So under the law, as it was explained to the jury in the jury instructions, the evidence does not support the conviction, and the conviction should therefore be reversed. The third issue in the case deals with the execution of a search warrant at the business that employed Mr. LeCount, Gates, Paul, and Lear. Mr. LeCount had a private office in that business, and I don't think there's any dispute that Mr. LeCount had standing to challenge the search, at least to the extent that the search took place in his private office. The Mancusi case from the United States Supreme Court tells us that he has standing to make that challenge.
So what evidence was taken with respect to the reasonable expectation of privacy aspect of the case? And if there was no evidence, what stipulations were entered into by the parties?
Detective Stewart testified at the suppression hearing that Mr. LeCount had a private office within the Gates, Paul, and Lear building. And the state at that point conceded that there was standing, that Mr. LeCount had standing to challenge the search of his private office.
And the reason I ask the question is, as I understand the facts, and I may be incorrect, and correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand the facts, one of the issues in this case is whether or not the materials that were obtained came from the office, correct?
Nobody knows whether the materials came from the office. That's correct.
And for purposes of reasonable expectation of privacy, is that not part of the burden of production the defendant has to meet in terms of putting the issue squarely before the court?
Well, the defendant's burden of production is a minimal burden. It is simply to present some evidence that his constitutional rights were violated. Detective Stewart testified that the documents that led him to Mr. Wills and to Northland Turkey Farms and to Murr Tree Service may very well have come from Mr. LeCount's private office. He just didn't know. He knew that there were files that were seized from Mr. LeCount's private office. He just didn't know which ones.
And Mr. LeCount never indicated or testified or stipulated that those files came from his office?
That's correct.
So if I understand what you're saying, the introduction to the warrant describes the premises that are to be searched as are those occupied or owned by Gates, Paul, and Lear at 2763 Manitowoc Road, and you're saying that within that description there was also a separate office of Mr. LeCount. Is that your complaint? So they didn't just search the offices of
Gates, Paul, and Lear?
No, I'm saying that 2763 Manitowoc Road is an office building, and within that office building,
right.
Gates, Paul, and Lear maintain separate offices for a number of its employees, including Mr. LeCount.
Well, but if they maintain the office for him, why isn't an office that is either occupied or beneficially owned, at least, by Gates, Paul, and Lear? Who paid the rent? I guess that's what I'd like
Gates, Paul, and Lear.
Okay. So in order for your argument to succeed, you'd have to have some separation here simply for LeCount. I mean, if the search warrant, I thought you were saying that they went outside the scope of the search warrant. Is that not your argument?
They went outside the scope of the search warrant by seizing documents that are not specified in the search warrant.
Okay, well, that's one thing. I'm just looking
not arguing about where they searched.
Oh, all right, because I thought when you said Justice Butler asked you what right of privacy did he have, a reasonable expectation of privacy, you said, well, he had a private office. Well, a warrant is, if it's based on probable cause, is not an unreasonable search, even though you may have an expectation of privacy.
Sure.
So your only complaint really is they took too much, not where they looked?
Exactly.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just misunderstood your answer.
No.
Thank you.
Which items of evidence that were introduced do you say were improperly seized?
I'm not saying that any items of evidence introduced were improperly seized. I'm saying they were derived from the illegal search.
Well,
they were the fruits of the illegal search, because Detective Stewart testified he never would have known about Murtree or Northland Turkey Farms or Mr. Wills if he hadn't started reading files, and those files were not authorized to be taken by the search warrant.
Okay, but can you identify those files that are in the possession of the state?
Well, I can identify from Detective Stewart's testimony that it was reading the client file of Northland Turkey Farms that brought Northland Turkey Farms to his attention, and that's what brought Mr. Wills to his attention. The record indicates that Mr. Wills didn't ever contact the police about his interactions with Gates, Paul, and Lear or Mr. LeCount. It was Detective Stewart that went to Mr. Wills, and he only went there because he read the client file. My position is he wasn't authorized to take or to read the client file because the search warrant didn't authorize that seizure. This was therefore the fruit of a prohibited search.
What else was the fruit of the prohibited search? Isn't it your job to specify that?
Well, no. It's actually the state's burden to show that any evidence it introduces at a criminal trial is untainted by illegality. It's therefore, I think, the state's burden to show that the evidence it introduced was not derived from the contents of files that were illegally seized.
And was that done, or at least attempted, before trial, in limine?
My objection was to all of the evidence that pertained to Murtree or to Northland Turkey Farms or to Mr. Wills, because Detective Stewart and the police in general didn't have any information about any of that until they started reading through client files they weren't authorized to have or to read or to seize.
Did you make a motion in limine on
Yes,
that?
Well, a suppression motion, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then, so that you were specific enough, and your view is that the state was not did not carry its burden of showing that the information it was providing came from files that were within the search warrant.
That's correct. And since I only have a couple of minutes left here, I think let me turn to the last issue, because it's a complicated issue, and that's whether sentencing Mr. LeCount as a repeater violated his right to a jury trial when there was no proof presented to the jury of the facts that are necessary before a judge is authorized to sentence somebody as a repeater in Wisconsin. The jury trial right was revolutionized by the Supreme Court in the Apprendi decision and in a series of decisions that extended past that, including Blakely and the Booker case. Apprendi articulates the rule that except for the fact of a prior conviction, any fact that is necessary to increase a maximum sentence must be proved beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury. The only exception to that is the fact of a prior conviction, but the Supreme Court has drawn a distinction between the fact of a prior conviction and facts about a prior conviction. The problem in Mr. LeCount's case is that he was sentenced under a repeater statute that doesn't look just at the fact that he was convicted. It asks whether that conviction occurred within the 5 years immediately preceding the commission of the crime, excluding time that he spent in actual custody or actual confinement.
Mr. Kelly, you mentioned that there's the Supreme Court has distinguished between the facts of a prior conviction and the facts about a prior conviction.
Correct.
Which is the case in which they do that?
Shepherd.
And my question about Shepherd is, I understand that Shepherd is basically a plurality decision. Is that correct?
I'm sorry?
Shepherd is a plurality decision with respect to that issue. Is that correct?
I think that's true. I don't recall, actually. But it certainly reflects, if you read all of the decisions, including Almendarez-Torres and Apprendi and Blakely and Booker, I think you find a majority of the Supreme Court on the same page with regard to this distinction between, with regard to the fact that they view the exception for the fact of a prior conviction as being a very narrow exception and possibly no longer good law, although they haven't reached that issue. Justice Thomas, in a concurring opinion, has said it's no longer good law. There isn't a distinction at all. But certainly Shepherd construes it very narrowly. And in this case, whether Mr. LeCount was convicted of his prior crime within 5 years of the crime of conviction, excluding time spent in actual custody, is not an issue that was presented to the jury, is not an issue that the jury decided. The judge, lacking that factual finding that only a jury could make, had no authority to sentence Mr. LeCount as a repeater because, as Justice Scalia says in the Blakely majority opinion, it is that verdict that authorizes the sentence. And in the absence of the verdict, the judge has no authority to sentence above the maximum sentence that exists if that fact had not been found. In this case, that would mean a 5-year sentence, which is the maximum for securities fraud, because to get to the 11-year sentence that was imposed, there has to be a jury finding that that Mr. LeCount was in actual custody for enough time that, if that's excluded, his last conviction and his current conviction were within 5 years of each other.
Because that Kelly, don't you have a couple of problems with that argument? One is the case that Justice Butler just mentioned, Shepherd, which I understand basically says that it's okay to have the court make the decision if the information is readily determined from the judicial record. And the state argues that it was readily determined from the record here. But in addition to that, I understand there's a U.S. Supreme Court case, Washington versus, and I can't pronounce the other name, but it's something like Rusensko. From 2006 that says this kind of an issue is subject to a harmless error analysis. And doesn't that give you yet another barrier to get over here?
I think the problem with the harmless error analysis is Justice Scalia's rather forceful language that it is the verdict that authorizes the sentence. If the judge lacks the fact-finding from the jury that the judge needs in order to impose a longer sentence, it can't be harmless for a judge to act beyond his judicial authority. If the judge isn't authorized to impose the sentence and he does something he's not authorized to do, that's not harmless. That's subjecting an individual to another 6 years in prison based on an act the judge had no authority to do. As for the other question about whether the record establishes the 5-year issue. When the Supreme Court in Shepherd is talking about a judicial record, they're talking about records that basically either result from a jury trial, like a judgment of conviction, or that result from a plea hearing where the defendant is admitting the facts that are necessary to the sentence, and in which a subsequent court can look at, for instance, a judgment of conviction and know that those facts were established. There is no judicial record at all in this case that establishes what length of time Mr. LeCount was incarcerated. There is a pre-sentence report, which is what the state refers to, but the pre-sentence report is an executive branch record. It's not a judicial record. It is, in fact, according to statute, it is something that comes from the Department of Corrections to assist the court.
Was there a certified judgment of conviction in, from the earlier conviction entered into the record in this case?
I don't recall if there was or not, but the judgment of conviction would not have told us anything. We didn't dispute the fact that he had a prior conviction.
But wouldn't the judgment of conviction reflect the amount of credit that was given right on the face of the judgment?
I assume it would, but there are other issues that go into whether he was in actual confinement rather than the amount of credit he had. There's also, you know, was he released early for some reason? Was he given a bracelet so that he wasn't in actual confinement anymore? None of that is addressed at all. And we don't, the only document we have is an advocacy document from the Department of Corrections, which is part of the executive branch, the same branch that is prosecuting Mr. LeCount. We don't have a judicial document with the same force and certainty as a judgment of conviction that tells us how long Mr. LeCount was confined and how long he was out of confinement. For that reason, I think that the repeater enhancement to Mr. LeCount's sentence has to be vacated. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. You have a few minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Freimuth, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. I am Assistant Attorney General James Freimuth, representing the state of Wisconsin as respondent in this criminal appeal. Mr. LeCount stands convicted of five crimes, and he's raising four claims of error on appeal. Before outlining the state's position on those four claims, I just want to link those claims to the particular counts of conviction. All four of his claims of error go to the trial that was held on count nine, the securities fraud claim that deals with John Wills and the investment contract. The other count at issue is one of four counts to which Mr. LeCount pled no contest as a repeater. And that's the Mere Tree Service case, that's count seven, and that was theft by Bailey. The only issue that addresses that particular charge and conviction is the search and seizure issue. With respect to the four claims of error, the state would ask this court to hold as follows. First, with respect to the expert testimony, the trial court properly admitted expert testimony on the nature of an investment contract as a security. Attorney Cohen neither invaded the province of the court nor usurped the role of the jury. And to the extent any particular piece of testimony is deemed going too far as a statement on domestic law, it would be harmless error for the reasons that are articulated in the Court of Appeals decision, namely that his testimony really did not depart from the meaning of investment contract as set forth in the jury instruction.
Isn't the circuit court supposed to set forth the law through jury instructions?
Absolutely. And I think this is perhaps the hardest issue, at least from the state's perspective. And I looked hard and tried to find cases close to being on point with this, and I did find some that go both ways. And I think it's a tough call because it's hard to think of examples that where you have an element of the crime that is so bound up in a legal definition, the meaning of investment contract. But I also think that when you have things like that, especially when they're very discreet and go to regulatory type activities, tax fraud, that in those types of situations, the information from an expert, and it doesn't have to be an attorney, it can be a business person. I mean, we're talking about the subject of it, the domestic law, that when you're talking about features, it may be helpful to a jury to hear that testimony. With respect to attorneys, I mean, one example might be the situation where somebody is, and it's a misdemeanor in Wisconsin to practice law without a license. What it means to practice law under particular fact situations may be something that an attorney will have be able to enlighten the jury about. And so in that situation, you're getting close to telling the jury what it means to practice law, but you're also providing examples. And I would suggest that if you look at Attorney Cohen's testimony in full in this case, for the most part, what he was doing was describing what an investment contract means, what the essential features are. Examples like a promissory note could be a stock, could be in certain situations, that his testimony was really not exceeding that bounds.
Counsel, you say for the most part that that's what he was doing. Do you agree with opposing counsel that there is a certain part of his testimony that contradicts the jury instruction that was given?
The closest that it might come to is when he's asked about the three features, I think, the three features that make up the definition of investment contract. The common enterprise, the feature about, pooling of the resources, that's the common enterprise, that the effort has to be done by somebody else with an expectation of profit. Those are the three features. Mm-hmm. But his testimony, if you look at it closely, really tracks the jury instruction. Now, the point about the jury instruction that Mr. LeCount tries to distinguish and say that this isn't really the four-way case or the Wisconsin law, which says that it doesn't have to come solely from the efforts of others. That last line in the jury instruction really isn't what the defendant claims it to be, if you read it closely, I believe. The third sentence of the jury instruction, the first two sentences on the meaning of investment contract come from the administrative code. The third sentence is one that was proposed by the defense and with some modification was agreed to by the prosecutor. That sentence says, if an investor uses his own efforts to achieve a profit, and then this is the key part, rather than relying on the efforts of a promoter or third party. But that's not what happened here. In this case, and I'll get to the facts shortly because I think they're critical for harmless error, not only in this context, but for the rest of the discussion, that's not what happened in this case. He was rather relying on the efforts of a promoter, namely Mr. LeCount. With respect to the harmless error, and first in the context here of the expert testimony.
Are you saying that because he was relying on the efforts of LeCount to achieve a profit, Willis was relying on it, that the testimony at trial fits the jury instruction? But isn't that a separate question from whether what the expert said fit the jury instruction?
Sure. But I think in this case that the expert's testimony did match the jury instruction, even to the extent that the expert arguably would have gone too far by talking about domestic law and telling the jury this is what an investment contract is. I don't think his testimony actually quite got there, but it came close.
Thank you.
With respect to harmless error and on the expert testimony, I think it's important to note at the outset that Mr. LeCount's defense was that he made no investment offer at all to Mr. Wills about the Northland Turkey property. So it wasn't even a question of did he do something that constitutes an investment contract. He was saying he made no such offer whatsoever. So that the meaning of investment contract really wasn't in play to that extent in his defense. His claim was that these various loans that Mr. Wills made to the firm, GP&L, where Mr. LeCount worked, were independent, had nothing to do with the Northland Turkey property, which was the subject of the investment contract.
Notwithstanding the fact that that was not his defense, nevertheless, it still is the state's burden to prove the case.
Absolutely. And that's what the rest of the argument here is heading towards, if you will. Mr. Wills said that all of the information for the investment contract to buy this Northland Turkey property came from LeCount and not from this other individual in the firm, which is what LeCount claimed. Mr. Wills claimed that he gave LeCount three checks totaling $64,000 for this investment proposal. was substantiated by bank deposit records. Mr. Wills accurately knew from LeCount that Northland Turkey had a $350,000 mortgage, but LeCount did not tell him that, that Northland Turkey also had two other mortgages totaling $300,000. Wills testified that LeCount intended to assemble five investors, not counting LeCount himself, to buy the mortgage, and that if foreclosure occurred within 6 months, as LeCount expected, LeCount would develop the property and sell it for $750,000 to $1 million, with the five investors then sharing in the profit. Wills testified that LeCount promised to manage the investment himself. And Stephen Meyer of Northland Turkey said, contrary to what LeCount told Wills, that Northland Turkey, was not interested in selling the property, that he had never discussed such a sale with LeCount, and that foreclosure was not imminent. With respect to the related issue of sufficient evidence.
Let me stop you right there, if I might, Mr. Freimuth. Is there also a claim here by the state that Mr. LeCount, by omission, failed to disclose information, in other words, information having to do with the fact he was a convicted felon and that he had been on parole?
Yes, that was another piece of testimony that I did omit just now, but it was a piece of testimony that was at least contested at trial. There was testimony that, at least from Mr. LeCount and I believe another defense witness, that Mr. Wills knew about that, about his prior conviction and his parole record. But that would have been, again, another factor for the jury to consider, at least in terms of the evidence showing material misrepresentations. With respect to the issue of sufficient evidence and the meaning of investment contract, Wisconsin is among the many jurisdictions to have adopted a broad interpretation of or definition of investment contract. It stems from the four-way case, which in turn is based on the administrative code provision. That language, the key language there, is that the essential managerial efforts of someone other than the investor. Essential managerial efforts. The federal case law, and the U.S. Supreme Court has not had occasion to overturn any of this federal case law, as well as a lot of state case law, is of the same accord. In other words, they look at essential managerial efforts as meaning significant, predominant, in some cases is the word used, but in Wisconsin the word is essential. The rationale for the broader definition, or among the rationales for the broader definition, is that if it was read so narrowly, it would frustrate the remedial purpose of the Securities Act itself, which is to protect investors.
Counselor, but that's not in the jury instruction, is it? Is that statement in the jury instruction?
I'm sorry, which statement?
The statement about the essential.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
It's in the definition of investment contract.
That's
I don't know if it's
at.
In the standard. It may have a reference in the standard instruction to the definition of investment contract. Is that what you're...
Okay, I'll look a little bit more. I'm sorry, I just didn't see it.
You have a copy of it, but
yes. I
could dig it out.
So. Thank you.
But the way the jury was instructed, the definition of investment contract, the first two sentences are from the administrative code, and the first sentence that defines it says, an investment contract is any investment in a common enterprise with the expectation of profit to be delivered through the essential managerial efforts of someone other than the investor. The broader take, if you will, on the meaning of investment contract comes in part from the remedial purposes of the securities legislation to protect investors. It also would be too easy to evade that by having just a modicum of effort put into a contract that the investor just does some minimal thing, and then it would not be an investment contract, and that's contrary, again, to the purpose of the legislation. In the present case, in addition to all the items I mentioned with respect to harmless error that goes to the expert testimony, which also goes to sufficiency of the evidence, I just want to highlight one piece of testimony from Mr. Wills, that even if you accepted Mr. LeCount's interpretation of the jury instruction in that last sentence, that it means it has to come solely from the, from the efforts of someone else. Mr. Wills testified to that. At the bottom of page 16 of my brief, quoting Mr. Wills' testimony, he says, "As it was explained to me," meaning from Mr. LeCount, "I wasn't going to have anything to have to do with it other than reap the benefit. Mr. LeCount was going to be the one that was going to spearhead the whole deal." So, in a nutshell, the investment contract was formed when LeCount promised Wills that Wills would be part of a group of investors to buy the Northland Turkey property, that Wills could expect profits from the essential managerial efforts, that is, the development and then sale of the property by Mr. LeCount. If there are no further questions on those first two security issues, I'll move on to the search and seizure and then the repeater. With respect to the search warrant issue, and this is the one that covers both the security fraud count that went to trial and the theft by Bailey count that Mr. LeCount pled to as part of the plea agreement. The state has three alternative arguments, if you will, on the search and seizure issue. The first argument is that Mr. LeCount failed to demonstrate either a subjective or objectively reasonable expectation of privacy in any specific records seized from his firm. He did not testify, nor did any other witness testify, that any of the specific documents that the state either introduced at trial or used to identify additional potential victims came from his office. Now, the prosecutor stipulated that his office was a private office, that he could expect to have both a reasonable expectation of privacy in. But Mr. LeCount provided no testimony at all to meet his threshold burden, which, by the way, is not some evidence, it's a preponderance of the evidence.
And Mr. Farmuth, let me ask you about that. I was trying to find the transcripts up here, and apparently I don't have them. I want to understand exactly how the expectation of privacy issue was handled at the circuit court. And the reason I ask the question is I recall a number of times as a circuit court judge where there would be a suppression motion filed, the parties would come into court, and the state would call their first witness. And my question would always boom down from the bench: are there any issues as to reasonable expectation of privacy before we get into the officer's testimony? And I would get that deer in the headlights look. That indicated that oftentimes the parties really hadn't contemplated that that might be an issue in the case. And I asked the question because I'm not sure whether or not the parties stipulated to reasonable expectation of privacy in this case, whether there was any discussion of reasonable expectation of privacy in this case, whether it was assumed by all parties, as often happened when I was in the circuit court. What does the record reflect here?
Two things. At the outset, well, the only person who testified at the suppression hearing was Sergeant Stewart, who was the person who executed the search warrant and drafted the search warrant affidavit. Mr. LeCount didn't testify. At the outset, the prosecutor agreed that to the extent that Mr. LeCount showed any document came from his office, he would have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that office. However, Mr. LeCount never testified at all, nor did any other witness testify. And in the argument after Sergeant Stewart's testimony, the prosecutor expressly argued that Mr. LeCount hadn't showed standing, meaning expectation of privacy. That's the basis, then, on which the trial court held that the records were admissible, that there was no...
Do you recall the record reference for that
for the trial court?
Transcript, exactly.
Sure. I'm looking at argument 3 of my brief on page 19. I cite document 66. I believe what happened was the trial court actually issued a two-page decision on the suppression ruling. And it's document 66.
You don't recall where in the transcript it is, though. Which transcript document it is?
It is document 66.
That's the written decision, correct?
That's the written decision. No. I don't know that it said anything on the record because it took briefs from the parties as well. In other words, they had the suppression hearing, and then my understanding was that the parties briefed it as well.
But my question is not what was in the briefs. My question is at the beginning of the suppression hearing,
yes,
where you're supposed to clear up issues of reasonable expectation of privacy, what, if anything, was placed on the record with respect to reasonable expectation of privacy?
My understanding is that the only stipulation, if you will, from the state was that if Mr. LeCount showed that the records came from his private office, he would have an expectation of privacy with respect to those records.
And that's going to be in the transcript?
I believe so, yes. I can't point to you right now.
I got you. We'll find it. We'll find it.
Mr. Frymuth, trying to follow up on that a little bit, I understood Mr. Kelly to argue that the way that Mr. Will was brought to the attention of Sergeant Stewart was through documents that would have come from LeCount's private office. Now, maybe I misunderstood that argument, but is there not that argument in terms of a link here?
As far as the return to the warrant lists various locations where documents were taken from, but it lists them generically, like files, computer files, paper files. It doesn't say anything about specific clients like Mere Tree Service or John Wills. At the hearing, the Sergeant Stewart, who was the only witness, had retired, and he hadn't had a chance to look at what all these various records and his notes about those records had been. And the trial court, in fact, the prosecutor said that if the court was interested, it would try to go back and find out which records may have come from which office and so forth. But that was never followed up on, and nobody asked for that to be done. So with respect to specific clients, there wasn't any connection between it coming from Mr. LeCount's office or someplace else. A couple of other notes, though, on this same subject.
Who had the burden to show where these records came from?
The defendant has the threshold burden by a preponderance to show both a subjective and reasonable objective expectation of privacy in those records.
We agree for the moment that he had a reasonable expectation of privacy for the records in his office.
If he showed that they came from there.
Yeah. So who had the burden to show which records came from which office?
I believe it was Mr. LeCount.
Okay, but Mr. LeCount said he thought it was the state's.
Right.
You disagree with that?
Right.
Okay. So you think it's his burden to show that this record was not in his office and you took it anyway?
Correct. With respect to the discovery of these, of the Mere Tree Service, Philip Mere is the manager. I think at the preliminary hearing there was discussion that some files actually had Mere Tree Service labels on them. At the suppression hearing, Sergeant Stewart testified that in talking to the Saharskis, who were one of the other complainants in this matter, that he learned from one of the Saharskis that Mere Tree Service was having problems with LeCount. So when he saw the label, I think a reasonable inference can be made, without even looking at the contents of the documents, which for all that is worth, it would really just be accounts payable, accounts receivable, that type of thing. It triggered in his mind, according to him, that this may be somebody to investigate. That's what steered him to Philip Mere. So regardless of what any particular document said or didn't say, I think a reasonable inference can be said that that's how they found him. Now, John Wills and CPR, the company that he operated, were doing the payroll for LeCount's firm. So mention of that name would be all over the records, presumably, because that was the company that was handling those activities. Therefore, when Sergeant Stewart contacted John Wills, who hadn't made any complaint to that point, that discovery of John Wills, if you will, clearly was, again, without having to look at any specific records. The records also, the records introduced at trial with respect to the securities fraud count, which is the John Wills situation, were files that were not in Mr. LeCount's exclusive possession. Most of these records were, or if not all of these records, were on computer. And the computer was apparently networked to everybody in the office, including the bookkeeper. The bookkeeper is the person who paid out the creditors of various people, and with respect to Mr. Wills, took in the bank deposit or the money that Mr. Wills was giving to Mr. LeCount as a loan, or as he claimed as a loan, but as part of the investment contract. So this information was not just Mr. LeCount's information, is what I'm trying to get at, but it was information that was accessible to the bookkeeper, to the Union State Bank official who testified at trial that he provided the checking account statements for the firm. Mr. Wills himself had a copy of a mortgage assignment, which was the document that LeCount had given him, according to Mr. LeCount, as collateral for this investment. According to Mr. Wills, as collateral for this investment contract. Turned out that the mortgage assignment to a property in Fond du Lac actually had a substantial tax lien on it, so it was not of any value to Mr. Wills.
Could I ask a question? The search warrant talks about the seizure of certain documents related to GP&L and then some named individuals. Did they take all of the records in his office?
My understanding is yes.
They pretty much took everything. And they took, how about the computer? They took the computer?
Took the computers off-site, is my understanding, to examine the computers. I don't know all the intricate details of how that worked. I know at the outset of trial, I think there was some issue about being able to reproduce certain aspects of the computers, but I don't really know the details of that.
Okay.
What about records outside his private office?
Sure. I mean, these were records that were taken from...
So they took them from his office and...
From other offices in the building, conference room, I believe.
Were they within the language of the search warrant, in your opinion?
Yes, and that's this all discussion so far has been just the standing or reasonable expectation. The other aspect of this, assuming he did, the search warrant itself was broad enough to cover all these documents.
Let me ask Mr. LeCount's position. Is it that when you go into the office, you can only take documents that involve the named individuals in the warrant?
That's my understanding of his argument, correct.
How do you know? Well, let's say, look at this table. Let's say in volume 3 there's references. How do you know that it's only volume 3 unless you go through the other ones?
Exactly. And the law reviews that talk about computer searches, for example, point that out. That is that at least at some level you have to make a cursory examination of whether something is or is not within the scope of the warrant. Now, here I'm saying everything was, not just the named people, but the warrant language itself was broad enough to cover John Wills and Muir Tree Service as well as the named individuals in the warrant. But even if you limited it to the named individuals, at some point you're going to have to go through these documents and figure out whether they do apply or not to those individuals. And in the course of that, as I said before, Muir Tree Service and John Wills were names that were prominent or readily discoverable in that process.
But if you see, let's say you take the files with the Tree Service, that's not named in the warrant. If the file is clearly labeled Muir Tree Service, why do you get to open that one up, even if you've taken it?
Sure. And the reason in this case is because the predicate paragraphs of this warrant are broad enough, the language is broad enough, to allow for them to take not only the named people later in the warrant, but it says any type of bank account or investment account owned by the firm, any type of bank account or investment account owned by Mr. LeCount or his co-defendant, Mr. Jarosek. Records relating to the payroll, accounts payable, telephone logs, accounts receivable, computer hardware, software, instructions, currency. It was broad. It was basically an all records search.
Well, would this warrant be any good if it just said after the premises, take everything.
You'd have to justify it.
Bring back everything.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think, no, I don't, that's probably too broad. If it just said that,
in
I
effect,
think you have
you're
to,
saying that's what this says.
No, all records, not the
don't
furniture.
Don't bring back the desk.
Exactly.
But everything in the desk.
Sure, records.
All papers and records at 2763 Manitowoc
Correct.
Road.
Correct.
That would have been an okay search warrant.
I think so.
Because that's how you're reading this.
That's
warrant.
How I'm reading it, yeah. And it, you know, and there's no challenge here. There's never been a challenge to probable cause.
Okay, but what I'm trying to get at, and
sorry,
there can be probable cause to say you can seize all the records that relate to GP&L and certain named individuals. And I can understand that as a matter of convenience, you would seize all the records in order to get at these records. But once you have a file that says mere tree service, how come you get to go in that file? Why do you think there's going to be something about SMC in a mere tree service file?
Okay, if you're reading the warrant as saying it doesn't allow it, you know, if that it's only limited to specific clients, if that's the way you read the warrant, you're right. You can't get into those that way. The way, however, or part of the state's, and actually this is the state's third alternative argument on this, is the name Philip Muir and Muir Tree Service and the name John Wills and CPR, those would be discoverable, at least those names, by looking at all these documents. Then the sergeant contacted John Wills and Philip Muir. Those contacts were permissible, and from those contacts, that information then was obtained, which would provide, I mean, he didn't go and get another warrant. Don't get me wrong. He didn't go and get another warrant for those. But with respect to discovering those witnesses and their testimony and whatever documents those individuals, Mr. Wills and Mr. Muir, had in their possession, those would all be admissible. Their testimony would be admissible. The discovery of, you know, the Northland Turkey person, all that would be, you know, would be legitimately discovered. Those witnesses, this is the Ceccolini case, by the way, from the U.S. Supreme Court, that talks about live witnesses are different than tangible objects. And that those witnesses, if they're properly discovered in a way that doesn't violate the execution of the warrant, those witnesses and their testimony still is admissible. And when you have that testimony, irrespective of specific documents that were taken in the warrant,
Chief,
that still comes in, and therefore it's harmless error.
Chief, if I could.
Justice Butler.
Mr. Frommuth, I know your light is on, but if you could perhaps take two or three sentences to address the Apprendi issue.
Great. There are two things I wanted to point out about that. One, I think it's a tricky proposition whether you should ever have a jury trial on aspects of a prior conviction, such as whether the defendant was in actual confinement. I think there's a logistical problem there. But even assuming that would be the law, and I hesitate, and I, like I say, I don't think that is the law. Washington State, there's a case that I cite, has said that's not the law, that's not what it should mean. In this case, you have, if you look at Shepard, and Shepard is the case that causes some concern, because in Shepard it talks about, well, this generic burglary wasn't evident on the face of the judicial record, and therefore that's not good enough. Here you've got a pre-sentence report, and I disagree respectfully with Mr. LeCount on this point. A pre-sentence report, in the case law, this is talked about as done independently of either party. The agent is an agent of the court for preparation of the pre-sentence report, so it is a judicial record. And it's a record that lists the actual confinement. Also, one final point on this is that, as Justice Crooks pointed out, there is a harmless error argument. When an issue hasn't been presented to the jury, if there's undisputed evidence on that proposition, it can be harmless error. In this case, after Mr. LeCount was sentenced, he never challenged, although he makes some suggestions that, well, maybe I was in home monitoring, maybe I had sentence credit. He never brought that to the court's attention. He never challenged that. After he was sentenced as a repeater on the securities fraud case, he pled to these other charges, and as part of that plea, he stipulated to being a repeater. So even if he was saying that there should have been a jury trial determination of this, he never raised any dispute of fact about that he, in fact, was in actual confinement or in home monitoring or some other something else that would not be actual confinement. And just one final point. As the Court of Appeals pointed out here, assuming there was no sentence credit problem, numerically, it had to come within that period based on the fact that he would only have been out after 6 months parole. It just would have to come in within that time.
The various release programs, early release, it's, challenge program, sure. there are a number of programs.
I'm saying without that. So, but that's, yeah, that hasn't, like I say, he never made that an issue, but at least on the
that
face
would, that, but that would not be reflected on the face of the sentencing document.
That's right. Sentence credit would on the judgment, but not necessarily, I don't think, the home monitoring aspect of it.
Thank you, Mr. Fryman. Mr. Kelly?
First of all, on the last issue, I don't think the record will reflect that Mr. LeCount stipulated that he was a repeater. I think he stipulated that the court could consider certain documents without further authentication of those documents, but very carefully preserved an apparently Blakely objection to being sentenced as a repeater. Maybe the most useful thing I can do in the couple of minutes I have left is to address Justice Butler's question about where standing and expectation of privacy appears in the transcript. It's in the suppression hearing transcript, which took place on July 1st, 2003. And starting at page 76, LeCount's defense counsel begins questioning to establish standing, questioning of Mr. Stewart. That goes through page 79 when the prosecutor begins to examine Mr. Stewart. And then on page 82, the prosecutor says the state will concede that inasmuch as there was a search conducted on an office that was supposedly Mr. LeCount's workspace, that office, the state will concede, the defendant has a reasonable expectation of privacy, or at least there has been a showing by the testimony of Mr. Stewart that he did. And then he goes on to say, but that's not true with regard to the rest of the building. So the issue of expectation of privacy and standing was addressed.
That raises the question. If that issue was addressed, and it was addressed specifically with respect to the office, what, if anything, was adduced at that hearing to provide any or at least any argument or testimony or evidence that the items that were seized came from the office?
Mr. Stewart's testimony that the client files that dealt with Myrrh Tree and Northland Turkey Farms and Mr. Wills may very well have come from Mr. LeCount's office. He just didn't know because when they took every document, and they came in and took every document in GP&L, hundreds of thousands of documents, they took up an entire property room. They didn't keep track of where they got the different documents. So Mr. Stewart didn't know whether they came from Mr. LeCount's office or from somebody else's office. He said they may very well have come from Mr. LeCount's office, and he knew that they did take client files from Mr. LeCount's office. He just didn't know which ones. It's our position that that established the minimal burden of production that Mr. LeCount needed to meet. It's merely a prima facie showing that, according to the Jackson case, requires only some evidence that the state violated his Fourth Amendment rights. We think that there is some evidence not only in terms of Mr. Stewart's testimony that these documents may very well have been in LeCount's office, but also the violation of his right to have a search conducted in a reasonable manner, which has been recognized by the United States Supreme Court in Anderson versus Maryland and by Wisconsin courts in State versus Noble. There wasn't a constitutionally reasonable procedure here. A constitutionally reasonable procedure would have had somebody keeping track of where these files are coming from, would have had somebody saying, this is a file that the warrant allows us to take, we'll take it. This is a file the warrant doesn't allow us to take, we're not going to take it, we're not going to read it. It's true there may have to be some cursory examination of files to see if they include what if they fall within the scope of the warrant, but that's not what Mr. Stewart did. Mr. Stewart took everything, and then in the leisure of his own office, in his own time, he read everything. That isn't following a constitutionally reasonable procedure to make sure that you aren't exceeding the scope of the warrant. And it's simply untrue that the warrant authorized the seizure of everything. If it did, it would be a general warrant.
Counselor, do you have someplace where you can quickly find it, either a cite to the record or a cite to you, a page in your brief, where the testimony of the expert witness is located that you say specifically contravenes the jury instruction? Okay. Thank you. Mike. Would you repeat that in front of the microphone, because I don't think you got picked up.
I'm sorry. The first volume of the transcript of the trial, which is January 12, 2005, and the specific testimony is on page 166. So with regard to the scope of the warrant, which I think is the last thing I'll say, the first six paragraphs or seven paragraphs talk about payroll records, they talk about bank accounts, they talk about computer data. They don't talk about client files. The only documents that talk about client files, or the only portion of the warrant that talks about client files, are paragraphs 10 through 14, which authorize paper records concerning SMC machines, Jeff and Irvin Saharsky, Donald Zellner, and a couple of other corporations that are affiliated with those folks. So I think the warrant is very carefully drafted to say, yeah, you can get accounting records, payroll records, records showing who your employees are, computer records that contain those kinds of financial records. But that doesn't authorize the seizure of client files. Only very specific client files are authorized to be seized. And if, in fact, paragraphs 1 through 5 authorize the seizure of every client file, then paragraphs 10 through 14 don't even need to be in this warrant. That's not a fair reading of the warrant. The warrant only authorized very specific client files to be taken, and those did not include anything that would have led the detective to Mr. Wills or to Northland Turkey Farms.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Thank you, Mr. Freimuth, for this interesting discussion on a broad search warrant and on a crime we don't usually have before us. That concludes our hearing on 06-AP-672-CR, State versus LeCount. Court's in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45, when it will hear the rest of the January calendar, and we will be in the closed conference beginning at 3:20.